From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowane with Fresh Air. I'm sitting in while Terry Gross is on vacation. Eric Bogosian's one-man shows look at the dark side of the American dream. He shows us the world through the eyes of everyone, from jaded executives to street people. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk with Eric Bogosian about his latest show, Sex, Drugs, Rock and Roll. Also today, drummer Charlie Watts of the Rolling Stones tells us about his other band, a jazz combo that pays homage to Charlie Parker. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. United Nations Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar said today that he's willing to meet with representatives of the Islamic Jihad, the group holding Americans Terry Anderson and Thomas Sutherland. The group announced in Beirut today that it was sending an envoy to the UN to resolve the hostage crisis. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The group sent a statement to a news agency in Beirut saying it was time to act with greater seriousness regarding the hostage problem. It said it would send an envoy within 48 hours to meet with Perez de Cuellar. In New York today, Perez de Cuellar indicated he is willing to meet with the group, but he also expressed caution over the report.
I have to be extremely careful in what I have to say, but I hope that what I am hearing is the beginning of the solution of such a tremendous problem for the hostages.
At the same time, a Tehran newspaper reported that two of the 14 Western hostages being held in Beirut would be released this weekend. The White House said today it is hopeful hostages would be released soon, but it also cautioned that there had been similar developments in the past that had gone nowhere. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
The European community appealed today to the United States and the Soviet Union for help in mediating peace talks in Yugoslavia. EC foreign ministers also called on the 35-nation Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe to help end ethnic fighting in the Republic of Croatia. The appeal came as members of the Yugoslav Federal Presidency announced yet another ceasefire. An EC delegation attempted to broker such an agreement over the weekend, but abandoned the effort amid charges that the Republic of Serbia was resisting peace efforts. The former president of Peru, Alan Garcia, has returned from a trip to Paris to deal with the scandal surrounding the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. Two officials in Garcia's administration have been accused of taking bribes from the bank. As soon as he arrived, the former president called a news conference to answer allegations of corruption. Mike DeMott reports from Lima.
Former president of Peru, Alan Garcia, says he welcomes an investigation to prove his innocence. The Peruvian Senate convenes tonight and is expected to form a committee to review Peru's dealings with the BCCI while Garcia was president. In New York, a Manhattan district attorney says there is evidence that the BCCI bribed two former officials of Peru's Central Reserve Bank with $3 million. The bribes were allegedly paid so that up to $270 million of Peru's reserves would be placed in the BCCI. Garcia says that as president, it was his business to know where Peru's money was placed, but that he knows nothing about bribes. When Garcia was asked if he would face a New York grand jury, he said absolutely not, criticizing the eagerness for such an appearance as a colonial mentality. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike DeMott in Lima.
The Dow Industrials gained 38 points today to close at 3,027. This is NPR. The Pentagon said today that there have been no firsthand accounts of Americans missing in action in Southeast Asia. Spokesman Pete Williams said there has also been no direct testimony from anyone who could identify the source of a recent photo that purports to show three living MIAs. American investigators are now on their way back from Southeast Asia. Williams said they were unable to verify the source of the photograph, which shows three men who've been identified as relatives by the families of several MIAs. The Pentagon has not declared the photograph a fake, although it said that the photo came through a Cambodian source who's been known to fabricate MIA evidence in the past. A federal appeals court ruling handed down today opens the way for a U.S. Senate election this November in Pennsylvania. Ed Ark from member station WITF in Harrisburg has details.
A panel of the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has overturned a lower court ruling which had put in doubt a runoff election to fill the seat of the late U.S. Senator John Hines for the remainder of his term. Today's decision clears the way for a face-off between appointed interim Senator Harris Wofford and U.S. Attorney General Dick Thornburgh, who's scheduled to step down from that post to seek the Senate seat. At question was whether or not the political parties could appoint candidates for a runoff, bypassing a primary for the election. For National Public Radio, I'm Ed Ark in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Newspapers in Israel reported today that Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir will not negotiate on the issue of returning the Golan Heights to Syria. The report said that Syrian President Hafez al-Assad is prepared to offer Israel a demilitarization along the border in exchange for the return of the Golan Heights. The heights, seized from Syria during the 1967 war, are militarily important because they overlook much of Israel. Nationalist members of Shamir's cabinet have threatened to leave his coalition if he negotiates away the Golan Heights. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. My guest, Eric Bogosian, is part of a new category in the theater described as monologuist, actor, writer. His shows include Drinking in America, Talk Radio, and Sex, Drugs, Rock and Roll. Oliver Stone made a feature film out of Talk Radio in which Bogosian starred as a talk radio DJ who's murdered by a right-wing extremist group. Now Sex, Drugs, Rock and Roll has been filmed by director John McNaughton. When Sex, Drugs, Rock and Roll opened last year, the theater critic for the New York Times, Frank Rich, wrote, "With this brilliant show, his funniest and scariest yet, Mr. Bogosian has crossed the line that separates an exciting artist from a culture hero. What Lenny Bruce was to the 1950s, Bob Dylan to the 1960s, Woody Allen to the 1970s, that's what Eric Bogosian is to this frightening moment of drift in our history." It's a one-man show with Bogosian portraying a series of characters, from subway panhandler to phlegm-spewing old man, sleazy wheeling-dealing entrepreneur, and macho Italian-American hoodlum. Through these characters, Bogosian is able to comment on a variety of social ills. Here he is, an aging British rock star, on a TV talk show.
I used to do quite a few drugs. But you know, Bill, drugs are no good for anybody. I've seen a lot of people get messed up on drugs. I've seen people die on drugs. I was saying to Trevor just the other day, I says, Trevor, how is it that we managed to survive, you know? After Jimmy died and Janice died, John died, I thought to myself, why didn't we die, you know? We should have died, all the stuff we used to do. Yes, I was, Bill, yes, I was. I was a bona fide drug addict. I used drugs every single day for 5 years. What was it like? I'll tell you, Bill, I used to get up every morning before I even brushed my teeth. I would smoke a joint. While I was smoking the joint, I'd pop a beer. While I was sipping the beer, cook up a spoon of heroin, cocaine, whatever's lying around the house, stick it right in my arm, get completely wasted. Flip on the telly, watch a little telly, maybe have some girls over, get high with them, order up some lunch, fool around with the girls, get high some more. I did that every single day for 5 years. It was horrible.
Do you like these characters that you've created? Do you have affection for them?
Oh, yeah. I have tremendous affection for them. When I do them on stage, there are nights when they actually feel like they're there on stage with me. Sure, they're like old friends. I don't know that if they were real people, I would have any affection for them at all. But they're not. They are characters. And it depends on how you look at the way characters get portrayed. But I always see characters as synthetic things. I mean, they're fake.
And
I wouldn't want to run into some of the characters that exist in my child's cartoons either. I mean, they're fake. They're synthetic.
Do you have to like them to play them? I mean, to be able to create them, does that come out of...
Well, there's always a common thing somewhere in me and somewhere in the character. There's a place where we're very similar. Sometimes it's a bit of a stretch, but it only has to be a piece of me. And it's like taking a branch of a tree and putting it on, grafting it onto another tree, and you get the same fruit. I just take a little segment of myself, let's say the part of me that once every 3 weeks yells at somebody on the phone, or once every 10 years has a drink with some guys on a corner and shoots the breeze, And then I take that and I build it up into a full-fledged character.
So the characters really come from you, not necessarily from things, people you've observed on the screen.
Right. I think the important thing, since so much of this show is about behavior, is to understand that I'm talking about myself. I'm not talking about somebody out there. I really don't like to point fingers because, I don't know, I think it's boring and I don't think I have any right to do it to anybody else. What I'm really doing is I'm taking sort of the demons that live inside of me and making them bigger and bigger and bigger. Sometimes they're very symbolic. I mean, one of the characters in the show talks about how big his dick is, and it's like this is a big thing for him, and it becomes a whole monologue, and it's funny because it's ludicrous. It's not really what I'm talking about, though. What I'm talking about a man who thinks that if he has some major position of power, he doesn't have to worry about anything else in his life. And so for me, it represents, let's say, being rich or being physically strong or being smarter than other people. And then I have no problem playing the guy.
Ever see a girl cry because she's so happy? Ever see someone beg to tear your clothes off? Ever see a woman faint because she's had such an intense orgasm? I have.
I can be up there. I happen to think I'm a pretty smart person, for instance. So I will be on stage, and when I'm, like, gloating about this huge member, what I'm doing is I'm just transposing me gloating about, you know, I feel extremely confident because I think I'm so smart. It's only one side of me, but it allows me to build a whole character out of it.
So you're figuring things out. I mean, you're using then these characters to try to figure out yourself, I assume. You're trying to figure out also this culture that you're living in, or that you grew up in, and now living with.
It's me. There are a lot of crooked paths in my life that they don't need to be straightened out, but they need to be looked at, just so that they don't upset me, I think there's a sort of a path to wisdom there. For instance, I think in the back of my mind, for a long time, there was a little voice that said, if you only made it in show business, you'd really be happy. If you were only rich and famous, then you'd be happy. Now, I can't say that I'm the most famous guy in the world, but the film talk radio gave me a certain amount of fame and a certain amount of money, and all of a sudden I found out that wasn't, there was no secret there at all, and there was no key to happiness, and that it didn't really change a whole lot for me anyways. So now I take this character, this boogeyman that lives inside of me, and I build it into a whole character, a character that's, for instance, completely focused on wealth. And then that becomes a way of looking at it.
Does it surprise you that people will go to the theater to see you try to figure out yourself?
Well, I think that people are going because they find me entertaining. In fact, a lot is made of the message that I'm trying to communicate, and I don't think that that's really what the whole thing is about for most people who come to see it. On a given night, 500 people come, see the show, and leave the theater. I hope that most of them feel that they got their money's worth. They were entertained, they saw something, and they go home, or maybe they have a little argument about it afterwards, and they go have some ice cream, and that's it. Maybe 5 people in the whole theater, or 20 people, were touched by what I had to say. They felt that there's a soul connection between me and them in the theater. And I know that that's something that I desperately need. I think artists have an inability to communicate and be close in day-to-day life, and so have this tremendous pressure to communicate through their work, and that's what's happened with me. I mean, today I feel a lot better about the people I spend time with. I spend a lot of time with my family. But nothing makes me more satisfied than to have somebody waiting after the show and tell me that they really, really got it and they know where I'm coming from.
Eric Bogosian is my guest today. His one-man show, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, it's just been published as a book and made into a movie which will be opening soon. That title, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, in the 60s was a kind of a cry of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Are you using it ironically because it's come to mean something different in the 90s?
Yeah, I think that you can look at it in a really broad way and say it's basically a if it feels good, do it, more is better credo that is kind of suspect. Or you can look at it specifically. I mean, sex is looked at very differently today in the age of AIDS than it was in 1969. Drugs is also come down to some very bleak place. And rock and roll itself, as the font of most of my philosophy about life, has really changed into something, for the most part, pretty insincere and pretty hypocritical. I mean, most of what I know about, I mean, living a life where my values are spiritual rather than material, or about being politically active or being idealistic or not trusting anybody over 30, it all came from rock and roll. You know, these guys, for whatever reason, in the 60s, were sitting around selling us the most high-minded idealism that has ever come down the pike, whether it was John Lennon or Bob Dylan.
And you bought it?
I bought it. I bought it, and it's in me, and it'll never go away. But given the situation of the world as it, I mean, I'm an older guy now, and if I think if John Lennon were with us today, he would be a different person. I mean, everybody has to adapt and change and learn. But rock and roll is almost like it's like church for me. It was like a religion for me, and as a result, I feel very let down today. So I'm basically turning the phrase upside down and inside out, and at the same time, I want to leave a lot of it open. I have a friend who is HIV positive back in New York, and he was complaining recently because he said, you know, the thing that's really a drag is that there's now this assumption that everything everybody did was wrong. Nobody should ever have smoked a joint. Nobody should ever have had any kind of wild sex. And he goes, they never admit that there was any fun at that point. And I'm not telling anybody to go use drugs, but I do think that life in the, if everybody were following the same straight and narrow existence, it would be a very, very dull world.
One of the characters that you play, he's a, for lack of a better word, a kind of aging rock star.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, we were having such a good time, we didn't realize what a bad time we were having.
That's the problem with drugs. You're having such a good time, you don't realize what a bad time you're having. Right.
Did you have bad times with drugs, you yourself?
Did I ever have bad times? Oh, sure. In fact, I think a lot of the times using drugs were bad times, and I at first a lot of peer pressure, and then later I think just a tendency on my own part to just sort of get loose every chance I got. I just kept doing it over and over again. It wasn't like something, but it was a fad. I mean, late 60s, everybody was dropping or popping something. It just took me a while to understand that I wasn't really enjoying it all that much.
Did you get into trouble with it, so to speak? I mean, did you find
I've gotten into just about every kind of trouble you can get into with those things. Probably the worst trouble of all, and I think it's one of the funny things about that culture, was that drugs were supposed to be freeing everybody up, and yet I saw a more violent, paranoid, and narrow-minded side of myself come out due to the use of drugs. And a whole lifestyle developed that was that eventuated in me becoming a person who I never wanted to be and I didn't expect to be. It's been an interesting road back, and I'm not sorry that I did anything that I did. I really don't want to repent here on the air on Fresh Air today, but it's I don't know. I think everybody has to go whatever path they need to go to. When I made the play Talk Radio, people asked me, were you making it about Alan Berg? Were you making it about talk radio? Were you a talk radio fan? I was making it about John Belushi because I was very moved by his death. In many ways, I related to the guy. He was essentially a suburban guy who made it big in the media and TV. And he just, he thought he could just be some kind of rock and roll guy and just do drugs and heroin and stuff. And he died. It's so easy to romanticize this stuff, and it's not romantic at all. When somebody dies, that's it. I know people who've died, and I know people who are institutionalized, and there's nothing nice or interesting about it.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is actor Eric Bogosian. His one-man shows include Drinking in America, Talk Radio, and Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, which has been made into a movie. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Eric Bogosian is my guest. Do you like, you really prefer working by yourself? Are you someone that likes to collaborate?
Collaboration is very, very difficult. It means that you kind of have to have an aesthetic blood transfusion with somebody else, and that may not work a lot of the time. I've worked with some really great people on collaborations, and I think in many ways I have been the more compliant partner because I've worked with people that I have tremendous respect for,
like
Frank Zappa or Robert Altman or Oliver Stone. But in every case, it has been really, really gratifying. As I find my own voice as an artist, though, it is harder to work with my own colleagues because we're all striving to find what we're trying to say to begin with.
Do you think of words as weapons in a way? Because certainly listening to Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, watching the movie of it, each of these characters has this kind of riveting, fidgety, nervous kind of presence on stage. And the words become, I mean, there is this body of you, the character, but the words are, I mean, mm-hmm. they're like, it's like machine gun fire in a way.
Well, I'm haunted by two major 60s notions. One is the medium is the message, and the other is we live in a one-dimensional society. These two notions tell me that, like, there's no escape. There's no way to really say anything anymore because ultimately, you know, no matter what you say on TV, it's still on TV, so it becomes TV. Or no matter what you say, no matter how revolutionary or progressive, it's going to be co-opted by the situation that it's heard in. And as haunting as those attitudes might be, I realized, especially just recently, the incredible power of words, that you can say something and it does make a difference. For some reason, although theoretically it seems that it's possible to co-opt almost any message and to undercut it, it's if you could, well, I learned it during the Iraq War that it's just saying we want peace now, we want this to stop now, was suddenly incredibly threatening to a whole group of people and actually very scary to say it out loud. I mean, if there were no power in those words, it wouldn't be so scary to say those words.
Do you find also, I don't know how old your child is, but also listening to them learn language?
Mm-hmm.
My
little boy Harry is—he talks a lot. He's four, and
why doesn't that surprise me?
No, it's really something, and I've noticed that he tries he's trying to find a way to organize the world, to explain the way the world works. I would like to tell him that it's futile, but, you know, he'll learn that in his own good time. There's so much about our nature as people that is, you know, you could say it's like the myth of Sisyphus. You're constantly pushing the rock up the hill and it's rolling back down. But so what? I mean, that's our nature. Our nature is to try to place order on chaos. Our nature is to try to strive for good even when it seems futile. And our nature is to get extremely involved with whatever is right in front of us at this moment.
Eric Bogosian is my guest. The movie of his play, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, will open on August 23rd. When did you begin acting? Was there a point at which you began to act, or was it something more
involved?
Yeah,
it was a pretty specific moment. I was in the 10th grade, and the teacher said, we're going to do theater today. And I was going to public high school. No, I didn't know anything about theater. And she just gave out roles, and my role was Juliet's father. And Juliet's father does a lot of shouting and yelling at Juliet for showing up late after coming home late after hanging out with Romeo all night.
Was this typecasting?
Well, at the time, nobody knew that I had any aptitude for it at all, and I slipped into the role, and I fell in love with acting, and that's the way it's been since. I love acting so much that I've run away from it a number of times. It's like I don't want to be a disappointed lover, so I stay away from it. I'm afraid, you know. I'm afraid I'm going to try and do it or be in it. And I won't get the opportunities I want. I don't really care about the money side of it. It's really...
Why not?
Well, I like making money, yeah. And I make money doing other things. I mean, my writing is very lucrative, but acting, I could do it. You wouldn't have to pay me. I mean, I turn down a lot of things because the kind of acting that exists in like TV and movies is most of the time not terribly interesting.
What kind of roles do you get offered? When Hollywood producers or TV producers are...
Well, first of all, I get offered roles of guys who have talk radio shows.
That's easy, right?
The next step is lawyers. And then there's another... There's a very large group. I'm Armenian. Armenians are Christian. But I'm very ethnic-looking, obviously. David Mamet pointed out in one of his recent books that... The Jewish producers in Hollywood don't want to have any Jews playing Jews in movies. I don't know if it's true or not, but I have played a number of Jews in movies. I guess I'm sort of like good at making believe I'm Jewish. After that, the kind of thing that I often get approached with is the terrifically bad guy that the good guy gets to kill at the end of the movie. You know, the guy who peels skin off of women or kills Patrick Swayze and haunts him or something like that. And I just, you know, if it were something like the kind of bad guys that Alan Rickman plays, then I'd say sure. But the thinking bad guys I love, Iago and so forth, Cassius, those are the great bad guys. But most of them... unfortunately, the kind of movies that are made, most of them are really, they got a star and everything supports the star.
Do you watch yourself on screen? Do you spend time doing that?
I mean,
invest
like
your time in
I
that?
I don't like to.
No, why not?
I don't like looking at myself.
Why not?
I don't like watching myself. This is like therapy. I don't like me. I don't know. You want to give me a pillow to punch here or something?
Just an innocent question.
I write a letter to myself here. No, I just, one thing is I'm very critical. And so, like, in the case of this film, I watched it one time and I said I can't watch it again because I see I want every beat and breath to be perfect. It's the great thing about performing live in front of different audiences every night. It disturbs the control side of myself. You can't get it right. There's no such thing. It would be like, again, I keep using the sex analogies, but you can't have sex perfectly. And it was like those books that came out in the 70s about how to make love to a woman. Like some guy's going to read a book and learn how to do it. It's the most horrible. And you can't do it. You've got to be open. And something I learned doing the shows.
Well, thank you very much, Eric.
Thanks
Bogosian.
For having me.
The film of Eric Bogosian's one-man show, Sex, Drugs, Rock and Roll, will be opening in the next few weeks. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. For nearly 30 years, Charlie Watts has had one of the greatest jobs in all of rock and roll, drummer for the Rolling Stones. But during all those years, another part of Charlie Watts has yearned to play some very different music, the music of jazz great Charlie Parker. Now Watts is getting his wish. Coming up, we talk with drummer Charlie Watts about his new jazz band. That and more coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Yugoslavia, the federal government has declared an official ceasefire in Croatia to start early tomorrow. However, fighting has continued in the breakaway republic for the last 2 days. Meanwhile, foreign ministers of the European Community met at The Hague today to try to find a solution to the crisis in Yugoslavia after an EC-sponsored peace mission failed over the weekend. NPR's Michael Sullivan has more.
The EC foreign ministers went into today's meeting calling for strong measures to deal with the crisis, but they emerged from more than 4 hours of talks without agreeing on any concrete proposals. Instead, they asked for assistance from another international body, the 35-member Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, to help bring about a settlement. The EC ministers also urged the Yugoslavian Collective Presidency to convene a peace conference to end the fighting. And in a message clearly aimed at Serbia, the ministers warned that any attempt to change Yugoslavia's borders by force would be unacceptable. That statement seemed to leave open the possibility of some kind of a peacekeeping force in the future. The Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe takes up the Yugoslavian issue on Thursday when their foreign ministers meet in Prague. I'm Michael Sullivan in London.
The Soviet Union has warned the West against military involvement in Yugoslavia. In a statement carried today by the official Soviet news agency TASS, Moscow said that Western military involvement could lead to a military conflict involving all of Europe. The Soviet government said that only a thin line separates friendly assistance and unacceptable interference in the internal affairs of another country. In the Soviet Union, Ivan Polaskov, hardline leader of the Russian Communist Party, has been forced to resign. Justin Burke reports from Moscow.
The announcement of Polaskov's resignation came during the first day of a Russian Communist Party Central Committee session. It appears many party moderates considered Polaskov's hardline views a hazard to the continued unity of the Soviet Communist Party. Over the weekend, a rift in the party developed with the formation of a democratic faction vehemently opposed to Polaskov's anti-market views. It's hoped the new Russian communist leader, Valentin Kuptsov, will be able to head off an outright party split. The communists have been trying desperately of late to reform before they are swept aside by the tides of change. Late last month, party leader Mikhail Gorbachev won approval for a new party program that's oriented to a market economy. For National Public Radio, I'm Justin Burke in Moscow.
Air France will resume weekly passenger service to Kuwait starting next week. Service by the airline had been suspended on the day that Iraqi troops invaded Kuwait. Cargo flights resumed Sunday. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 38 points to close at 3,027. This is NPR News. A group believed to be holding Western hostages in Lebanon says that it is sending a special envoy to the United Nations. Attached to a statement to a Western news agency in Beirut was a new photograph of Terry Anderson, the longest-held American hostage. In New York City, the UN Secretary General said today that he has not received a request for a meeting regarding the Western hostages, but he said considerations would compel him to receive an emissary. The chairman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, L. William Seidman, told President Bush today that he will leave his post in October. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
In a brief three-sentence letter to the president, Seidman confirmed what had been expected for some time. He will step down from the FDIC chairmanship October 16th, the last day of his term. Seidman has directed the FDIC, which insures both bank and S&L deposits, through one of its most tumultuous periods since the Depression. More than 1,000 banks have failed in the past 6 years, nearly exhausting the deposit insurance fund. Seidman has been promoting William Taylor, the Federal Reserve's Director of Bank Supervision, as his successor, but the Federal Reserve has come under a cloud since it was revealed that the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, or BCCI, had secretly acquired the Washington-based First American Bank Corporation. There was no word from the White House on Seidman's successor. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
West Virginia Senator Jay Rockefeller has scheduled a news conference tomorrow, and the Associated Press is quoting a party source as saying Rockefeller will not run for the Democratic presidential nomination next year. Rockefeller's office will not comment other than to say he will make a statement on his presidential intentions. In Poland, a government-appointed panel says that it will work with Western experts in an effort to help a tractor enterprise get out of bankruptcy. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. He's not up front like Keith or Mick, but drummer Charlie Watts is the steady rhythm behind the Rolling Stones. But since he was a kid, Watts' other musical love has been jazz, particularly the sounds of saxophonist Charlie Parker. He's formed a quintet, and they've put together a tribute recording to Charlie Parker called From One Charlie. Watts has stayed in the background through all the celebrity that has been such a part of the Rolling Stones. Watts says it's by choice. A chance to talk about Parker, the new recording, and a children's book he wrote about Parker's life brought Watts to the NPR Bureau in London. I asked him if he ever fantasized about being Charlie Parker.
I did actually make a saxophone out of newspaper when I was really young and tried to be like him. I mean, it's a life that I've always... in a Hollywood kind of way, loved, you know? The smoky nightclubs, 4 o'clock in the morning, 52nd Street, Parker playing.
So it was the New York jazz scene, as well as Charlie Parker himself.
Yeah, I mean, when I first went to New York with the Stones, the first thing I did was to go to Birdland, and that was it. I mean, I'd seen America. I mean, I didn't want to see anywhere else. That was it. I got to Birdland and... The rest of it was just waiting to go home.
How would you compare the job of a drummer in a jazz band versus a rock and roll band?
For me, they're the same, but that's me in my simplistic way. But then I was brought up at a time where the jobs were the same. You know, there's no difference to playing with, I don't know, an R&B band, as they call it, to a jazz group, you know. There are subtleties and nuances that are there, but most of it, I mean, it's basically physically the same. It's time, You have to keep time and you have to keep certain things together, hopefully. And it's a sweat when you go on and a sigh of relief when you come off together at the end. So it's, to me, it's always been the same, really.
I was thinking that you might listen or watch somehow differently. Of course, I've never played drum in either a jazz or a rock and roll band, but do you find that you watch and listen differently, Charlie?
No, not really. I mean, I watch Peter the same way I watch Mick, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing with playing with Mick is that it's rather like playing with James Brown in a way. You have to try, you catch where he is every now and again, you know? And for where we are in a song, I have Keith. And I watch Peter for those marks, really, and David Green is the bass player.
What do you get from jazz that you don't get from rock and roll, from playing it?
Oh, I don't know. It's the same, you know. If it's a good night with the Stones or anybody, it's a good night. It can be the same in jazz. I just love sitting there and hearing Peter King play a saxophone. And to be paid to do it is quite nice.
There's such a different lifestyle associated with jazz versus rock and roll, and I would think you kind of live in two worlds then. And I wonder how you kind of square the high life of rock and roll with what for many jazz artists is a kind of relative poverty and anonymity.
I suppose they're not two different lifestyles for me. I mean, one is 90% bull, but then I suppose if you're in a jazz world, I mean, they're only names, aren't they? I mean, you're trying to make your living as a drummer or a bass player, saxophone player. I don't know, you know. It just seems easier to make your living if you've got three guitars and a drum kit than it is if you've got two saxophones and a trombone player. You know, it just seems easier to book a band like that, regardless of how good they are. It's not really about playing an instrument, is it?
Well, are you bitter about that?
No. I'm fortunate, you know, I can pretend I'm Duke Ellington at one minute and then pretend I'm James Brown the next, you know. So, I have both, you know, I can do both. I don't mean I can do them well or anything. I mean, I'm accepted in both, so I don't devote my life to either, really, although I suppose I have with the Stones. I mean, I've devoted my life to a band that happens to play well, that's all.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking to Rolling Stones drummer Charlie Watts about his new recording with the Charlie Watts Quintet. It's a tribute to jazz legend Charlie Parker. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Drummer Charlie Watts is my guest. I want to pick up on something you said, Charlie Watts, about the 90% bull. If it is 90% sort of garbage, what keeps you going at it?
What keeps you going at it? I love playing the drums, and I love playing with a band called the Rolling Stones. It's what I've done. It's what I mean, I can't say I don't now and take 30 years back and say, oh, that was a mistake. I'd like to go over that bit again. It's what I do. I've enjoyed it very much. And they're a good band. They are good. But what you were talking of, referring to, was the life's kind. I mean, I've always thought it very silly. not the music, but the image of it. The same way that jazz musicians generally are known to be totally self-destructive people, and maybe the life makes you like that, you know.
How are you able to avoid that? And you've also
me,
yeah. How and you've also avoided the spotlight to a certain extent. On of course working with a band that's
you just keep out of the way.
Is it that simple?
For me, it was. Yeah, I've had my moments, all of it. But you see, I wouldn't particularly want. I don't like doing these sort of things particularly, so if you've got five other guys that do it as well as you can, I would sooner somebody else do it.
Do what?
Interviews and things like that. The spotlight, you call it. Whereas with this project, there is no one who can answer your question about how did I write the book or how old was I? So I can't hand it over, unfortunately, to Peter or whoever.
Well, is it you don't like the questions that get asked in terms of doing interviews? You don't like the questions that are asked, or you feel like there are no answers?
No, I don't really like talking about it. It's just what I do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I love talking about Parker and the music. I don't mind that, but I don't like talking about what I do in it particularly. It's not something I like doing. So with Mick, for example, I just say, I know that he talks as well for me as whatever. So I just say, well, you do it. Or I just don't turn up. And he does it, you know, and it's wonderful. So I don't have to bother with that side of it.
Well, you don't do drum solos either, right? I mean, is that all part of your desire to stay in the background?
It's I can't do them. I never liked them. I'd never liked them as a young man. I've just finished a book by a guy called Bert Corral, a very good book called Drumming Men. And he was obviously fell in love when he was young with Gene Krupa. And I never liked Gene Krupa at all. I like him now more than I did. But I've never liked that sort of showman drumming. To me, I've always preferred band drummers. You know, I much prefer Shadow Wilson and Kenny Clarke type of drumming. I mean, my favourite drummers are not great showmen or great soloists.
When people talk about a Charlie Watts style of drumming, do you know what they're talking about?
No. To me, that means the lowest common denominator you could think of in a rhythm.
You mean the most basic kind of rhythm?
Yeah. But people think that's really something else. To me, it's total lack of technique. But I quite enjoy guys that play like that. I mean, one of my favourite drummers is Al Jackson. And to play like Al Jackson takes an awful lot of control and subtlety.
Do you think you're a good drummer?
Not particularly, no.
But you think you're with a good band? Rolling Stones.
Yeah, I'm with a good band with this quintet. I hide behind those facts.
Is that right?
No, I don't mind. I love playing rhythm, but I don't like being a front man. That's why with that orchestra that I got together one time, it was not, I should have been more out the front like Buddy Rich or something, if one could ever be like that. But I mean, and I'm not that sort of person, so I can't really, I'm not a very good band leader for a start. You have to be a certain type of person to be a band leader.
Do you tire ever of being a Rolling Stone?
No, I'm not allowed to be tired.
Is that right? This will go on forever?
Keith would soon ring you up and tell you to get your act together, I think it would be. No, I don't really. I mean, I get tired of people saying things that you've heard a million times, but that's all. But that's not their fault. That's your fault for not being able to handle that situation a million times better.
Do you ever outgrow the road?
I hate the road. What, do you mean touring?
Yeah.
I hate it. It's a lot of fun, but I don't like leaving home, and I hate packing a suitcase.
Do people still scream at Stones concerts the way they did back in the 60s?
No. No, I think you have to be young and good-looking, don't you? Even girls actually scream.
Well, does that mean that then you can play the music as opposed to having to play the music over the screaming?
It's all the same, you know. I mean, one is just a one noise. I mean, there's nothing more thrilling than going on a stage with all that chaos going on. There isn't. It's incredible to have lived through it. I mean, what I hated about it was when you got off the stage, I could never behave like a sensible human being. It was all silly, like running in baker's shops with hats on and that. I mean, I'd never liked all that. It's a fantastic thing to have lived through. And for me to sit here as a balding old man telling you that it was quite a moment, it's all gone as well. I don't really think about it, actually.
Are you recognised?
Who, me?
Yeah.
I don't know. As what?
As who you are on the street, yes.
Yeah. But I don't know. Yeah, a lot of people say hello or aren't you. Yeah.
Do they keep their distance?
No, I keep mine. I think. I don't know, really. I never think about it, you know.
Charlie Watts is the drummer for the Rolling Stones. He's got another musical side, playing drums in his jazz quintet. The Charlie Watts Quintet has released a tribute recording to Charlie Parker called From One Charlie on Continuum Records. Packaged with a CD is a children's book written by Watts in the 60s about Charlie Parker called Ode to a High Flying Bird. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us about the show today. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Marty. William Seedman, who is heading the Resolution Trust Corporation, the outfit that is attempting to bail out the savings and loan industry, has decided to step down. The United Nations is receiving a deputation from the Islamic Jihad to discuss the holding of Western hostages in Lebanon, and Turkey has been staging some fairly substantial raids across the border into Iraq, chasing Kurdish separatists. We also have a number of other features, including a continuation of our series on rape, Rape and the Law, and how it's changed in the last 10 years.
Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. World music commentator Milo Miles calls Cuba the communist country with the best beat. And as the cultural barriers between the United States and Cuba continue to fall, the effect on Latino American pop music may be profound.
David Byrne is at it again. After serving up the polyrhythms of Brazil in great heaping gobs on four anthologies, he's now going after Cuba. And though Cuba is tiny compared to Brazil, it's a much harder nut to crack since Castro's revolution. Until 3 years ago, bringing Cuban music into this country was considered trading with the enemy. So Byrne has called his second anthology of Cuban pop, Dancing with the Enemy. Before we get to that album, we have to deal with the first volume of Byrne's so-called Cuban classics. Silvio Rodriguez's greatest hits features a whole style of music that evolved in Havana during the 60s, hidden from the U.S. It's known as Nueva Trova, which roughly means new troubadours. And Silvio Rodriguez is one of its leading lights.
¿Cuánto de pesadilla? Quedará todavía, quedará todavía. Si pienso que fui hecho para soñar el sol y para decir cosas que despierten amor, ¿cómo es posible entonces que duerma entre saltos de angustia y horror? En mi sábana blanca vertieron hollín, han echado basura en mi verde jardín. Si capturo al culpable de tanto desastre, lo va a lamentar. Si capturo al culpable de tanto desastre, lo va a lamentar. Lo va a lamentar.
As those horn parts might suggest, Rodriguez and Nueva Trova were hit hard by the Beatles. In fact, not only the Fab Quattro, but all of 60s music shaped the style. Bob Dylan and singer-songwriters especially, but also the whole idea of the studio as a zone of high-tech creativity. The arrangements on Silvio Rodriguez's greatest hits are as tricky and tasteful as anything the Norteamericanos were doing in L.A. at the time, and the stars singing and guitar playing are as flowing and sincere as you could wish, and most of the time it sounds like a James Taylor album with really sharp bass lines. Sorry, but to me, Rodriguez's Nueva Trova is just soft rock sung in Spanish. Oh yes, his lyrics are smart, elusive, graceful, and not too tainted by propaganda, but nobody should have to read the lyric sheet to enjoy pop songs, and that's where most of the astute stuff is with Rodriguez. Not to say that he doesn't come up with a couple killer hooks in the collection.
Thank you.
esta al fin me engulle. Y mientras por su esófago paseo, voy pensando en qué vendrá.
Byrne's latest collection, Dancing with the Enemy, is the first part of a proposed two-part study of other pop music in communist Cuba. This volume covers the 60s and 70s. The second one will tackle the 70s and 80s. Are there any revelations? No, not exactly. The standouts here are the performers who have had the best word of mouth over the years. Singer Celeste Mendoza and the band Los Van Van, for example. And is the lack of commercial pressure an audible relief, or is that just my imagination? Anyway, this is music from a country where the traditions of catchy pop, jazz, and flat-out dance music remain intertwined. With Byrne's flair for pacing at a peak, Dancing with the Enemy has the vitality everybody talks about in Cuban music, but that so rarely holds up for a whole album. This one is zesty through and through. Recent years have suggested that once restrictions are loosened on the flow of culture and ideas between communist countries and the outside world, it becomes an unstoppable torrent. Unless a doomed crackdown occurs, more and more recordings from Cuba will show up here, more and more bands will tour both countries. It will be an exciting period, and world music fans should be in the forefront. There are scads of Afro-Cuban music anthologies, but I'm going to recommend just two more that highlight Cuban performers still in Cuba. The first is Cuban Dance Party, Roots of Rhythm, Volume 2, which includes a few performers from the Byrne collection. The second compilation is Oye Listen, Compacto Caliente, which has bands and singers from all over the Spanish-speaking New World, but lines them up in a wild tour ride. First of all, though, remember you need friends like David Byrne to help you dance with the enemy.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The interviews on Fresh Air are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with help from Joan Tuohy, Roberta Shurrock, and Sue Spolin. I'm Marty Moskowain.
Diana, 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 Diana. Diana, 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 Diana. Diana, 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 Diana. Maria Belén.
Estoy aquí.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The campaign trail is a grueling, stressful, seemingly endless slog to Election Day. On the next edition of Fresh Air, we examine the effect of campaigning, not on the candidates, but on their wives. Joy Shuck has interviewed dozens of candidates' wives, and she was one herself. We'll talk to her on the next Fresh Air.